Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Mind Rolling Podcast with Raghu Marcus and David Silver.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning. We're doing this early in the morning because it's too hot where David is. So
yeah, it was hot. Now it's a little cooler out today, and we're very happy about that. Of course, if you're listening to this in the middle of December, this will be surreal.
Why would? Oh, that's true. Yeah.
I find that people listen to podcasts, you know, out of order and all kinds of things, and
they just discover us.
It's a good thing, really, because I mean, why should you listen to them in order? Really, there's no, you know. Actually, one of our listeners wrote to us and said they love the podcast, tremendous enthusiasm, but they hate the music and said it sounded like two old men farting. That's our introductory music,
which is kind of a bad because this we didn't make this music. This music is Krishnadas, actually. It's Krishnadas loaned us his one of his songs, which we took a piece of. And it's a very hip thing, I thought, and thank God they weren't saying two old men farting for the whole podcast, which is, you know, really would have been depressing.
But I don't get it, because it's very, you know, with music at the beginning of a podcast or a show or a TV show, you can't have anything that's too sort of, you know, I don't know, too heavy duty, because people get sick of it. This is very light, and I don't think it's like a small fart or a large fart. I think it sounds like,
melodic fart.
Melodic and Krishna death. Yeah. So for the person who wrote to us about that, we're sorry, but we're not going to change it.
No. And if other people have written and said, hey, can you let me know what that song is so I can get that? So, do you want to have a vote? Okay, people can tell us whether or not.
Yeah, tell us if you dislike it or if you like it.
Yeah.
Then we'll do nothing. But at least
That's not true. We listen hard.
Yeah, I mean, if everybody said they thought it was horrible, we'd change it. Yeah. But that's going to happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now I have some self-interest want to present to you.
That's unusual.
No, come on. Well, it ties into, again, we've been told by our mentors and Duncan Trussell, most especially, you must, at the very beginning of the podcast, you've got to get right into it and talk about how you need some support, and which we do. And David's gotten angry before, and that seemed to have worked quite well, actually, by the way, everybody, a little anger. And so we're going to talk, by the way, about anger, and we're going to talk about self-interest, or what's called in Tibetan Buddhism, self-cherishing, because we found this fantastic article, a commentary by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and we're going to discuss. But before we discuss it, we're actually going to show you our own self-interest, but not anger. I think we'll leave David out of this today. But I'm going to, this is a book which I'm going to read a little passage of, and the self-interest is, this is a book by my mom, who passed away last year. And her name is Bela Marcus. And
we didn't do the Amazon thing, though.
I'm doing it. It's a little bit of a preamble here. Just give me a chance. It is available on Amazon, okay? What's interesting to me, but I just happened to pick this up, it's kind of just by chance, as David and I were talking about what we were going to talk about today, and I found this passage. Now, my mother was interested in our whole journey. I think I've mentioned this before, that my whole family had been to India and had become devotees of Neem Karoli Baba Maharaj. A very unusual family, including my mother. And her first foray into this was to come hang out with us in Queens, New York. And this was in the mid-70s. And she was, just a little briefly, she was this very pragmatic, she was actually a Marxist. And when we came back from India, she looked askance at all of this hippie, Hindu, enlightenment, spirituality stuff. But just because she was curious, she came to the scene in New York, which the teacher at the time that we were hanging out with was named Joya, and we have mentioned her on previous podcasts, a very charismatic figure. Ram Dass had a huge falling out with at that time. Maybe we'll further investigate and talk about her. But she was very magnetic, very charismatic, and very profane at the same time in her teaching. And so my mother came to this thing, and she loved Joya because it was just, she wasn't into, you know, New Agey kind of spirituality or anything like that. And so there was a lot of practical things like that she got from Joya, like cleanliness is next to godliness. My mother loved that.
So, or she would say, you have a really fucking dirty mind.
Yeah, right. And she would, you know, virtually punish people and do all sorts of weird things, which we won't get into. But this particular little passage from her book, it's great for, you know, I hadn't remembered. Of course, I've read the book, but I didn't remember this particular thing. And it's about my mother's... you know, here we are doing a podcast where I'm supposedly, you know, speaking in a very flowing and well understood and with tons of elocution in that manner. So then I this is funny because my mother had a whole other view of me back then. So Joya says, listen to your son. And she named my mother Brahmama. Do you remember that, Dave? Dave was around then. And of course, yeah. And that's where we met. And listen to your son. Everybody listen. Raghu's going to tell you about a miracle. Go ahead, Raghu. Now, I got to tell you, I have no remembrance of whatever this dream or whatever happened. Raghu stood up to speak. I never heard him speak out loud to a crowd. I hardly ever heard him speak. He wasn't much of a talker. He always mumbled. I wondered what he had to say all of a sudden. A miracle? Yeah, he said he had a miracle happen to him last night. He talked for half an hour, only I didn't know what he said. He was in a forest? What forest? He went to bed like the rest of us. Maybe he woke up and went for a walk to Forest Hills, the other side of Queens. He met Maharaji there in the forest, and all kinds of things happened to him there, all kinds of Hindu things. He and Maharaji swam in holy waters. Gods came down from mountains and chased enemies away. I wish I did remember this dream, Dave. And in the end, Raghu found enlightenment. Incredible. Half of it I couldn't hear, because he was still mumbling, and the other half made no sense at all. No sense to me, anyway. All around me, I was hearing far out in hushed tones. To me, he was more far away than far out.
That's a great line.
Yeah. Later, I learned he had entered into a spiritual trance, samadhi. When it was all over, I got the kind of smiles you get when your son is class valedictorian. Being that I had left my straight life behind me, and being that I wasn't searching for meaning, I was quite happy to assume the role of celebrity mother. Such a big shot I became that I was soon elevated to a responsible position. It's good, right? I mean, this whole book is funnier than shit. It's her memoir.
We have to add that she was an eminent teacher and scholar of the psyche, and whether we call her a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a therapist, and you just didn't mess with her. I mean, she was wonderful and extremely
straight shooter. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And
forensic psychology was her specialty, and she wrote papers in Montreal and was very prominent in that.
She was brilliant.
Yeah, she helped a lot of my friends out in one way or another with therapy. So, yeah, it was. So this book is really quite funny. It starts with her growing up in Montreal, and you get the whole scene of growing up Jewish in Montreal back then.
What's the title?
The title is The Beautiful. Bela the beautiful Bela Marcus. And so here's the self-interest. Go to Amazon. Not only should you bookmark Mind Rolling Podcast on Amazon, Mind Rolling Podcast on your search bar, and then be able to just click it easily whenever you want to buy something on Amazon. So not only were you going to help us out and support us through that, but you also are going to get my mom's book, and the family will get a few more shekels. So this is like a double, you know, what's the Yiddish word for, you know, double good luck? I don't know. Emes, something like that. I've forgotten my Yiddish. But
I really don't know.
Yeah, because you're really not that Jewish, Dave, okay?
No, I'm not. But I do know Jewish words. I know, you know, kvetch, and I know...
Gesundheit.
That's
like Larry David. That episode of Larry David, and he's trying to convince the rabbi to get his friend Richard up the list to get a new kidney, right? And
yes.
Then he goes to him and acts like he's a chassid, like he's a religious Jew. And he keeps saying stuff like, Gesundheit, Gesundheit, like
that
he doesn't know anything.
Knew.
It was fantastic. Another thing, you can get that episode probably through Amazon as well, by the way. So please help us out. We need you to, we need this continued support. So, I mean, Dave says we're into what? Episode 79? We're like over the year and a half line mark, you know, by the end of, you know, even maybe more. I'm not even sure.
No, but by next month, we're in 2 years.
Oh my God. Okay.
We started in October 12th.
Really?
So it's been 2 years, and it does take a long time to build this stuff and so on. But just got a check from Amazon yesterday, and it was disappointing.
Oh,
but we're not gonna berate you with that. And speaking of words, I used the word bathos in the last podcast, and someone wrote to me and said that surely that word doesn't exist. Well, look it up. Bathos. That's all I have to say. We like to report on what people say, because they say nice things, but they also sometimes say you guys are lunatic.
Yeah.
So, you know, we love you all. You know, yeah, Bela was amazing, amazing woman, beautiful woman, too. And an example to me of a, thank goodness now that I'm reaching that age, of an older person who just didn't see any need to do anything other than be herself. And she was extremely beautiful, even in her 70s. And I'm one that believes that I'm very old-fashioned about this. I think that, you know, if you go with what you have and make the most of it, it's probably worth it more than plastic surgery or Botox.
Yes.
We know none of you do that, of course.
Yeah.
But if you're tempted to, just give yourself a good look in the mirror and say, I'm beautiful. This sounds like New Age stuff. I got to stop.
Yeah.
Where's New Age?
Dr. Phil is now in the body of Dave
Dr.
Silver.
Phil.
Yes.
Phil is a provocateur. I watched his show twice.
You did.
He provokes people into being awful, and then he yells at them, which is a bit much. He's a protege of Oprah, you know.
Hey, I know that, yeah. I find that that's probably the darkest mark on Oprah, as she produced Frankenstein over there. He's nice.
He's a lovely fellow.
Yes, he is. He's really lovely. Dave, did you have something else in mind here? I can't remember now. You said...
We're going to talk about Holiness's wonderful treatise, and I think we may have a little thing about depression later on, particularly if we get depressed during the podcast. But we were looking for weird stuff, and which we always do, because just to sort of laugh it up a little bit. And I found something.
Yuck it up.
Yeah, I found something not that wonderful called 11 Things You Didn't Know About the F Word. Okay. And I'm only going to read one, actually, because I thought that it was very funny. It says, one thing you don't know is where it comes from. We don't know how it got to Britain, which is where the word sort of was used first, and it came from Scandinavia. There's a town in Austria which people go to as tourists because the town is called Fucking, which, no. You know, I would change the name of the town if I were the
not
man.
At all. Not at
but
all.
But people come from all over the world to stand next to the sign.
Yeah, the only commerce they have is I'm going to Fucking. That's it.
I also read something on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, which said the people who use curse words are usually nicer people. Now, where they got this from, I don't know. I really don't know. And I was brought up in my family to say, if you have to use a curse word, you don't have any vocabulary. And if you can't think of another word, don't use any words. It was kind of like people didn't swear in my house, which is sort of strange. And I've become a swearer in my later life, but I'm trying to stop it because it doesn't help on the whole. But, you know, that word still excites people into anger and, my goodness, how could you use that word on TV and all that? It seems kind of silly given the state of the planet that we should worry about a four-letter word. And, you know, that's all I have to say about that.
I just want to know, is the fucking Austria, does that word mean in Austrian something else? I mean, what's going on there?
Let me look at my source here. It says, for some reason, travelers who speak English take particular pleasure in arranging a day trip to a tiny village in Austria. When they arrive, they always take a selfie alongside the village sign. Some of them have even been known to dig the signs up and take them home. Oh, my goodness. Why? Because the village bears the unfortunate name of fucking. No, it doesn't tell you anything about it or why, what it means in German. You know, God knows. I mean, it could mean anything.
We should investigate this. We'll send one of our investigative reporters to Austria.
It leads us to the question of bad-mouthing and, you know, which is a really lame segue.
into
His Holiness, who we don't badmouth.
Hey, by the way, can I say something about this? Is His Holiness is going to be in New York. For those of you who are in New York or want to go to New York, he's going to be there on the 3rd and 4th of November. Just, you know, if for those of you who haven't been with him, I mean, it is... Even if sometimes the teachings get rather arcane, Tibetan teachings, his presence is outstanding. I don't know what the right word. I mean, it's darshan, what they in India call, you know, being in the presence of a revolutionary being, one who has gone beyond I, me, mine. And his only interest is compassion. He really is, you know, a representative of Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion. He really is that. So what's that place on the Upper West Side, Dave?
I think it's the Beacon. But
the Beacon. That's true. That's it. I know. I'm going. Okay. I got some tickets myself, so I would.
Did you read the letter we got from, or not the letter, the article about being I don't like the expression, but a white trash Buddhist.
I saw that. Yeah, I haven't read the article, though. Did
I read
you?
The whole thing, and it's really quite something, because what he talks about is the fact that Buddhist retreats and other retreats are too expensive for him, and that he had to, and he was told, oh, well, you know, you got to go to him or you never learn anything. And it was only later that he started to understand that you could read books, you could do all kinds of things. There are online Buddhist schools that are free, and we'll try and you know, extend that information on the new website when we change our website, which we're doing, to give more information that comes out of the podcast. But his point really was that he says, you know, Buddhism is an upper middle class American trend, and as great as it is and as good as it does for people, many people can't afford to go to retreats. And he doesn't say that's bad. The retreats are bad. He said they have to pay rent, they have to pay electricity, they have to do all that, so they have to charge people. He could never afford to do it. And it's an interesting article because it connects economic well-being or not well-being with the ability to connect with them, to learn from Buddhist teachers. And the good thing about the article is that he never once says, you know, that Buddhism itself propagates financial gain. It's just a question of survival, and particularly these retreats that are not making tons of money.
Yeah,
well, but he does say that there are difficulties for people these days who have to work maybe at two jobs, don't earn enough money to do much more than pay the rent and get food and pay for gas, and they just can't afford anything else. And we should be aware of that.
Well, it's and that's all absolute truth or relative truth, not absolute truth.
Right.
Whatsoever, but more relative truth is, you know, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there is a necessity for giving something for receiving the teachings. So there is that tradition. And there's that tradition, I think, in almost, well, certainly one, the ones that I know, of course, in Indian, in the Hindu tradition, absolutely there is that tradition of giving, even if it's just a piece of fruit. So that there is an, you know, exchange of giving and receiving that is going on in the relative world. And the other thing is, in terms of, you know, there's truth to the, I mean, never mind having the money to be able to go afford to pay, you know, and these tickets with His Holiness, they're a couple hundred bucks, I think, something in that realm. I mean, they're not outrageous, but they're definitely something. I mean, they're nothing like going to see the Knicks, that's for sure. You know, how much that costs and how worthless that has been in the last few years, but that's a whole other subject. But, you know, let's just take somebody with means who, never mind going and paying for retreats, which are expensive, but you can just, you know, have the time to actually just, you could go into a room in your house and retreat there and sit and do reading and meditate, whatever. That's a luxury because, you know, just to be able to take that time indicates that you have the wherewithal to be able to do that. So there, you know, in another sense, though, again, in the relative world, you know, there's the story of Krishna and Sudama, who was a poor beggar, right, who used to go and just offer, you know, grains of rice and had no time. He was just working all the time to try and survive. And just the purity of that particular offering and in as much time, you know, talk about time and space, that he had, eventually he was... you know, he became in some realization through the purity of his offerings. So, you know, the relative reality of having the wherewithal to either take the time or actually pay for a teaching versus the reality of what karma and grace and all of that, where someone just in one moment offering purely can get what somebody who tries lifetimes of paying thousands, tens of, you know, thousands of dollars for teachings doesn't get to. So there's no, you know, there's a relative reality and then there's the absolute reality, which of course is beyond
yeah,
us.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, and it's not good to be put off by statements that say that you necessarily need to do it one way or another. Everybody's quite different. And, I've read so many books that have helped me. I would be, you know, lying if I didn't say that books had been a channel for me to grow in many ways, hopefully, and also to learn about very esoteric as well as very practical things. And books are a miracle, and, you know, we should not forget them and do too much whining about we can't afford to go to a Vipassana or something. Yeah, it's unfortunate, and but there are always ways. If you want to, you can work,
exactly.
You know, certainly at the Buddhist place I went to in New York a few years ago, you could work, you could be in the kitchen, you could do things like that. And they were never closed to, and this is a great Lama who teaches there, they were never closed to someone who, they would never say, okay, you can't come in. It's not like going to see a movie. You don't have $15, you ain't coming in. It's very rarely like that. And so, you know, but books are great, you know.
Let's move into this.
This is
commentary on the 8 verses of thought transformation, which we could all use. Again, by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. It explains the practice, which is called Paramittayana, and its method and wisdom. And the first 7 verses deal with method, loving kindness, which is bodhicitta, and the 8th deals with wisdom. And so the very first thing is the thing that you and I talk about almost endlessly on these podcasts, because it's the thing that everybody faces day to day to day. And most particularly you and I, of course, it's called self-cherishing. And I love that word. Let me just quote a little bit. There's 2 attitudes to consider. That of selfishly cherishing ourselves and that of cherishing others. Okay? 2 attitudes. the self-cherishing attitude makes us very uptight. We think we are extremely important, and our basic desire is for ourselves to be happy and things to go well for us. Yet we don't know how to bring this about. In fact, acting out of self-cherishing can never make us happy. And, you know, I guess in my own case, I find the most difficult thing I find in my life day to day after all of these decades of work on spiritual work and blah, 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 is the, you know, I have a healthily developed, I would say, witness. So the biggest thing for me is to see this self-cherishing going on moment to moment. And in some cases, I have not been able to stop the judging mind. We had that podcast last week about the inner judge, and I think that was really important stuff as well. And, you know, and I find that very, very difficult to see the transparency of this self-cherishing and self-interest. And, you know, it's just amazing how the ego works. And later in this thing, he talks about how the ego mind is very, very clever and hard to, maneuver into transformation. Those who have the attitude of cherishing others, okay, so this is like an antidote, right? Those who have the attitude of cherishing others regard all other beings as much more important than themselves, and value helping others above all else. Huge, huge hill that sounds like to climb, right? And acting in this way, incidentally, they themselves become very happy. Right? Very, you know, try and convince people of this. That would be difficult. For example,
well, it's really hard to convince people. If they don't have that source in them at that moment, you know, you can say a million words, but it may not work. And there are also confusions caused by modern political and ideological movements. There's nothing wrong with self-empowerment. Racial minorities and women and gays and so forth have fought for 40, 50 years now intensely about gaining respect and equality, and rightfully so, of course. But that's self-empowerment. That's not being trodden upon and creating an atmosphere where everybody gets respect. That isn't self-cherishing, right? That's different. So if you're fighting for your rights as a woman or a gay woman or gay man, that's not self-cherishing. That's just simply saying, I want to be respected for who I am. Whether everybody makes that distinction is another question.
That's a very good point. I think, in terms of examples of what this is, I mean, it's just waking up, you know, in the morning and, you know, everything, our first thoughts are about how to satisfy ourselves.
Right.
Right? I mean, even if it's just relieving ourselves from, you know, going to the bathroom, it's as innocent as that. To the next step, which is our cup of coffee and, again, more self-satisfaction. That is only the case if you are tremendously attached to, you know, to that satisfaction. What he's talking about here is we are so attached to our self happiness and gratification that it's at the expense of everything else that's around us, everyone else that's around us. Mm-hmm. Awareness goes away, you know, and right. that is the key. It's not about, in terms of, you know, you're talking about gay rights, you know, a person really asserting themselves for their rights, or a person asserting themselves for their rights to, you know, what's going on now. For instance, one thing I read in the paper was about minimum wage. You know, I think there's a bunch of people out in California that are going on, are striking, you know, or are marching for that. Is not that is not the definition of self. That is something that is, you know, fighting for rights is not define you as self-cherishing, self-interest, self-centered person. So, yeah, I think that's a great point to make.
Can we make the same comment on the other end of that, which is if a Hillary Clinton or a Rick Perry or a Rand Paul spend millions, untold millions of dollars advertising themselves, is that self-cherishing or is that just a way to get themselves elected so they can do good for other people?
Well, it's interesting because here His Holiness says, when talking about self-cherishing and cherishing others as an antidote to that. For example, politicians who are genuinely concerned with helping or serving other people are recorded in history with respect, while those who are constantly exploiting and doing terrible things to others go down as examples of bad people. So I don't think it matters how much money Hillary Clinton spends or Rick Perry spends on getting reelected. That's part of the game. I think it more matters. And, you know, and that's what we thought about Obama. I mean, look what he did. There was tremendous money spent for him to get elected initially. And we all thought this is a genuine good person who cares about other people and genuinely wants to do something about it. I think so. It's you know, and further into this these commentaries, His Holiness talks about motivation, and I think that's really part and parcel to our whole attitude around, you know, self-cherishing. What is our motivation? So I think in relation to what you're talking about, I think that's the first thing we ask.
Yeah, I saw on TV yesterday the woman who was infected with Ebola in Liberia or wherever they were Christian missionaries and a group that, you know, some of us are neutral about, some of us are not. And she spoke for a long time, and I don't think she'd ever spoken in public before. And she spoke about getting the disease, how she got it, what happened, the process of it, and so forth. But her main thing all the way through was her absolute, you know, she was frightened because she got this terrible disease, but she was more concerned about the hundreds of people outside her hut who were getting it that wouldn't get any care at all. And what, no matter what you think about evangelicals or whatever, these doctors were helping people in desperate straits. And not only that, but they got the disease, and they should have died from it. They just were lucky to get some kind of new medication and great treatment at Emory Hospital. But when I was watching her, any kind of prejudices I had about being missionaries and converting the Africans to Jesus disappeared because of her absolute clear and obvious purity. The woman had no guile. She just was talking about she had to help these people. And even at this point, where she'd been through a hell of her own, she more cared about how these people were being cared for or not cared for now that they were gone. And I was quite moved by this, actually. I was very moved by it. It brought tears to my eyes because she is a woman who's just given her life to help people who've got no money and no status in society and have, you know, got this awful disease. So that's not self-cherishing, right? That, even though she was forced to speak, she didn't want to talk, but the media, you know, forced her to talk about it.
This is a great example of somebody who's caring for others superseded her own self-interest whatsoever.
Absolutely.
I mean, obviously, you know, there's a complicated thing, you know, as you we don't even need to get into. I think we take it for face value. You really heard the heart of this person.
Yes.
And I think that says it all. Just moving forward a little bit. Here's His Holiness. Again, this is, you know, we're spending a lot of time here on just the very tip of the iceberg of these commentaries. He says, our life is not very long, 100 years at most. If throughout its duration we try to be kind, warm-hearted, concerned for the welfare of others, and less selfish and angry, that will be wonderful, excellent. That really is the cause of happiness. If we are selfish, always putting ourselves first and others second, the actual result will be that we ourselves will finish up last. mentally putting ourselves last and others first is the way to come out ahead. Okay, how about that? You know, it's kind of like it's the opposite of Vince Lombardi, but I think...
Well, it's the opposite of what's conceived of as an American dream in some ways, which is why some people can't sort of grok His Holiness, because he's constantly talking about this. But he is the Dalai Lama of compassion, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's his central core. Yeah. And what he's trying to explain to us is that there's nothing wrong with looking after your family and gaining some security and whatever, although there is no security in life in a way. You just it's not entirely in our hands. But he's just
not
trying
at all
to inculcate into us in a friendly and lovely way that, you know, being a number one all the time and being after number one and the word exceptionalism, which is a word I take great exception to, you know, when people use it to say we must have American exceptionalism. Are they talking about kindness to the world, or are they talking about a better economic system than anyone else's and a bigger military? So His Holiness constantly reminds us in this miraculous way that we have this human being in this very difficult world we live in right now, that we have this person to remind us, and he has gained global respect. It's not like this is you're doing this in a vacuum. People all over the world know who he is and take note of what he espouses in the most delightful way. The only time I ever met His Holiness was at a private event some years ago. And just before I met him, one of the monks said to me, "Whatever you do, don't shake hands with him, just pranam, you know." And I thought, okay, that's perfectly normal and everything. So I had about 10 minutes in line. And then when I got to him, you know, being British and stupid, as soon as I met him, I put out my hand and shook hands with him.
No, you didn't.
And he shook my hand I couldn't get his hand off my hand. He just shook it and shook it and shook it. And then he touched my shoulder and laughed and smiled at me. And we had a nice couple of minutes together, and then I moved on. So even he isn't self-cherishing enough to say, "Oh, you didn't shake my hand, you didn't pranam, get away from me." You know, he didn't.
No,
he's just a bundle of empathy and.
And you can see it just in the way he acts with everybody around him, with honors everything. So when you have somebody who's living what he's talking about, the words that he speaks are so powerful. Here's something he says. Some Western psychologists say that we should not repress our anger, but express it, right?
Right.
Archetypical. That we should practice anger. However, we must make an important decision here between mental problems that should be expressed and those that should not. Sometimes you may be truly wronged, and it is right for you to express your grievance instead of letting it fester inside you. But you should not express it with anger. If you foster disturbing negative minds such as anger thoughts, they will become a part of your personality. This is so much truth. Each time you express anger, it becomes easier to express it again, and you become self-identified with it. And I know that so well. I mean, this is, talk about speaking right to me. You do it more and more until you are simply a furious person, completely out of control. Thus, in terms of mental problems, there are certainly some that are properly expressed, but others that are not. And, he talks about how cunning the mind is around all this stuff, and very difficult. And, he talks about a book that he still practices according to a book that he studies day to day. It's called, A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Shanti Devas, which is a marvelous book. What you've said about, you know, having access to knowledge and wisdom through books, this is in particular, he's saying this right away.
The words, a great teacher. I mean, I just want to quote something here, which I love. I've quoted this before, but I want to use his words, Raghu. He says, when we compare ourselves with animals, for instance, we might think, I have a human body, or I'm an ordained person, and feel much higher than them. From one point of view, we can say that we have human bodies and are practicing the Buddha's teachings, and they're thus much better than insects. but from another, we can say that insects are very innocent and free from guile, whereas we often lie and misrepresent ourselves in devious ways in order to achieve our ends or better ourselves. From this point of view, we have to say they were much worse than insects, which just go about their business without pretending to be anything. This is one method of training in humility. Mm. How much wisdom is there there? I mean, you know, I just can't even express my gratitude to these, to him, for what he speaks of constantly and reminds us that we need what, you know, in Shakespeare's The Tempest, he invented the phrase, a sea change. I'm not quite sure of the derivation, S-E-A change, meaning just change. You know, take this seriously and don't reduce yourself to a punitive, self-punishing guy like those guys running through the streets of Baghdad, flailing themselves with nails. That's not what he's after. He's after a gradual, honest realization by your own self-witness about where you're really at and trying to modify that. I mean, Raghu says he's an angry person, but you didn't know him 30 years ago. And he's not nearly as angry as he was then. And I, you know, nor me. I mean, I can get wildly angry about certain things, you know, but it is important to gradually pay attention to that witness who you've been told about. Then you realize you have that witness. It is who is looking at your own. I mean, who is looking at these tendencies and obsessions? That's the thing to get into. Who is looking? And when you realize that there is something looking, you understand that that is bigger and better than this ego dictator who guides much of our behavior. Yeah. Look at the world. If you're going to argue with this, then we'll just look at the world and how much division there is, how much it could be improved if some people, all of us, in fact, I don't want to preach. Stop preaching, Dave.
That was a good preaching. I kind of liked it. By the way, one real great thing to offer with this stuff, which our friend and mentor Ram Dass has been talking a lot about in the last couple of years, is the practice of loving awareness. And that allows, because Dave is just speaking very... high wisdom stuff, because it's from what perspective are you witnessing this stuff? Because the mind, as His Holiness says, is very cunning and can take over almost everything. So I think the perspective, and Ram Dass's whole thing lately has been about moving out of the perspective of mind ego into spiritual heart and witnessing from there. That's a huge difference, and it takes real practice and so on. You know what? This is a lot of levity, isn't it? I propose that we break it up, because...
much levity, I mean.
It's not levity. Okay, see, I had the wrong... You know, without you, I'm done.
Well, it's early, and we're it's doing this early in the day. Did you have your coffee? Did you have that?
I had my tea. I'm sorry. Okay, this is non-levity. Too much non-levity. But Dave, before... actually, in the last week or so, he's been turning me on to some music. So I thought, why don't we have, you know, we are getting to a point where, we're way into and close to the end of the podcast, but okay. I want us to have a little bit of levity now, right? And music is, the best way for that. And the other thing is, Dave, we've gotten to page 2 of 8 pages of this commentary. Yeah. And I thought, why don't we, because it gets just a bit much, I think we could break this up into some other podcasts, right? Because the next thing he talks about is, super important. It's all about motivation. So, Dave, how do you feel about... So Dave's been talking to me about George Harrison, so I thought that perhaps we could play a track or two from, and this is what, George's Brainwashed last record?
I think Brainwashed is his last record. I think it was 2001 or something like that. And I myself didn't really know this record in any real way, and it fell out of a drawer a few days ago, and I started listening to it. It's not every song is equally great, but Raghu chose a couple that are quite beautiful and show the the depth of George Harrison and how lucky we are to have had him as a musical, you know, Pied Piper.
Yeah, and listen, the words on this one is called Rising Sun. You guys can listen in particular. The words are pretty amazing. You know, again, George was in a. He knew, that he had a severe illness, and he was what we call on the edge of awakening. So these were very relevant. So let's just listen to this thing for a minute or more than a minute.
Villains take him for a ride. You can have the devil as a guide. Crippled by the boundaries, programmed into guilt, till your nervous system starts to tilt. In the room of mirrors, you can see for miles, but everything that's there is in disguise. Every word you've uttered and every thought you've had is all inside your file, the good and the bad. But in the rising sun, you can feel your life begin. Universe at play inside your DNA, and you're a billion years old today. Oh, the rising sun and the place it's coming from is inside. Inside a doctor's case, when I heard the messenger from inner space, he was sending me a signal that for so long I had ignored, but he held on to my biblical call. Oh,
Right.
Excellent. Excellent song.
Yeah. I love the line, and in the rising sun, you can feel your life begin. Universe at play inside your DNA. You're a billion years old today. I mean, you know, Ram Dass speaks so eloquently about the whole universe being in within you, inside of you. And I think that's what George was beginning to feel as his mortality became obvious to him.
Yeah. You know, one other thing, it just occurred to me as I was listening. We actually did a podcast with our friend Duncan that's not out yet. Dave and I were talking about that. And in part of that podcast, we were talking about the Hare Krishna movement. And it's the guru of that was A.C. Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada. And, you know, we... let's just put it this way. I feel like, you know, we had some judgmental stuff going on about it, and me in particular. And I have, on the other hand, I said, you know, jokingly, I had gone to this Hare Krishna convocation where they were singing, you know, what's called Maha Mantra, the Hare Krishna, Hare Ram Mantra, and how I was going to join them because I was so taken by their... incredible the way that they did the kirtan from such a pure place and with so much feeling. And I've had mixed feelings about this. Dave just told me about, he has some footage from the television show he did many years ago that shows him in the temple and how in the Hare Krishna temple. I'm talking like when he and I were getting into this, which is 69-70, a long time ago, and how, you know, he totally got into it. And I remember getting into it as well, and I had respect. But then as the whole airport, getting accosted in the airport thing, and then some really bad shit that went on with this big temple they built in Virginia, and we don't have to get into that. We certainly had a lot of judgmental stuff, some of it based on, you know, on reality. But there was one guy... who through it all, right, really had a pure relationship with the Hare Krishna people, with the movement, and with the actual efficacy of that mantra, and that was George Harrison. And, you know, and I've always thought of him, whenever I think of disparaging stuff, how he was able to keep a certain respect, and then he made that incredible record, right? Well, he made a record with them that is, I think, hard to get. It's something you and I should try and figure out how we can get that and advise people to go up on Amazon through Mind Rolling Podcast and buy it. He expressed it as a celebrity pop star, you know, incredible musician. He integrated that better than anybody.
And, for sure.
Yeah.
And for sure. And made some beautiful, you know, music out of it. I mean, when he does chants, which he does at the very end of this record, Brainwashed, they're so beautifully done without any guile or any kind of pop star vibe on it. Obviously, he experienced, you know, so much in his life that most of us don't. Adulation and all that comes with fame and glory. Mm. You know, and at the end of the day, his greatest album, I think everybody agrees, is called All Things Must Pass. And I might say that in my little world, that album is one of the few albums from that era that I constantly listen to. I'm not a big nostalgia person. I don't listen to the Beatles and all that from those times usually. But when you hear All Things Must Pass and songs like Beware of Darkness and Isn't It a Pity, I really recommend it for those that don't know that album. All Things Must Pass is just quite beautiful and very, very inspiring to me. So we're finishing on a George Harrison.
Yeah.
Harrison.
And here's some more self-interest. Dave produced, and, you know, you won't have to take it from me, but from according to, you know, people who really know in the industry and in the music industry, he was part of and wrote and directed the best Beatle doc that's out there. Okay, I mean it's self-interest. It's I'm on behalf of Dave. giving I'm self-interesting for you. How about that? Because it is an incredible doc.
Go to YouTube. It's called The Complete Beatles.
No, don't go to YouTube. Go to Amazon and buy the damn thing. Come on.
I have to say, just to warn people, that they're rare now. And
really?
I've seen them as they cost quite a bit if you go to Amazon, up to $500 for VHS or DVD.
Shit.
So so few of us can really indulge in that. There are some less expensive ones, but it's all on YouTube in many parts. You
the
know?
Complete Beatles. Let's give them the title, okay?
Complete Beatles, and it's in many parts on YouTube, but I'm happy to say that it's very well, it was a good copy. It's not degenerated, and the resolution's pretty good, and the sound is pretty good.
We should get the rights back and produce wonderful DVDs. I mean, what in the heck?
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, Warner's bought it from MGM. We did it for MGM and then United Artists, and then Warner's bought it in the 90s, and I guess Warner's owns it now. But they haven't put it out for quite a while, and it does talk.
Anybody out there who works for Warner, you know, give us a buzz, and we... you know, maybe we can do something about it. But, Dave, we're at the end of the road of this podcast, and I love this this commentary by His Holiness. Fantastic, and I want to continue that next week if we can, if you don't mind. And, you know, and continue to analyze our own self-interest with mindrollingpodcast.com and making people go there and support us and donate. By the way, we've gotten some donations recently that have been really nice, and buying our T-shirts and going to Audible if you want to listen. Oh, I must make this last commercial, audible.com. Go there and buy Ram Dass's newest book, read by Rameshwar Das, his co-author, Polishing the Mirror. Fantastic reading, and you can have it, travel anywhere and have Ramesh, you know, who's a good friend of ours, have this delightful reading, Polishing. It's also out now in paperback. You can go to ramdass.org, and you'll find it all right there and be able to access it immediately. But go to audible.com. And you can get a free 1 month subscription that you can cancel, and you can get a bunch of books. And then once you do that, we get again some more shekels of support. So another,
by the way,
more self-interest.
Raghu, we should mention that we'll put on the website and on Facebook and so forth the link to this commentary on the 8 verses of Thought.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's actually Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive, but.
Okay.
If you go to Lama Yeshe, Y-E-S-H-E.
Put it, yeah, get it up there. And
we'll publish it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for today. I just loved it. I love, you know, really investigating our, particularly, you know, these themes, which are so important and hopefully can help us all transform a little bit. So see you next week, Dave.
Yeah. Ciao.
Bye-bye.